Welcome to Eucharist Church.ca.
This is a sermon that I haven't preached in a couple of weeks, and this is a sermon that I'm really on the edge of whether it's like, wow, I think this will really help people and really like encourage and shift things for people, or like just no one's going to get it. And so I'm really praying that it falls to one side and not the other. Would you guys join me? We'll pray for a moment. Holy Spirit, you are in this room with us, ordinary us. You've called us together to meet you and to meet one another. Light our hearts up. Expand our imaginations. Help us to receive your love and to be transformed by it. Thank you for every person that has taken out time of their chaotic week to be in this space with one another, for the gift that that is. In Jesus' name, amen. So I've always been drawn to Christians who kind of set up base on the edge of faith. You know, I like Christians that are honest about life, and they're like, it's messy, and they're honest about doubts and struggles, and they invite in all the weirdos. I've just loved that kind of thing. I like Christians that swear just a little bit to be edgy, you know? Like, just, I like the Christians, and especially spiritual kind of leaders, who have made space on the edge for people who may not fit in normal church structures. And so when I was first doing my master's in seminary, I got a chance to intern under a pastor who I thought was like the best at doing that. This guy was a pastor at a church in Toronto that I got to intern at, and he was like poetic and was like just beautiful preacher and would pull people together and made this kind of messy church home. And I was like, that's so compelling. That's the kind of church that I would love to see. And so I went up and was like, I need an internship. Can I have an internship? I just want to learn more. And they said, yes, you can have an internship. I was like, awesome. The first week I went, I watched him, and it's where like he broke the bread. You know, like break the bread and you try to like make it like really dramatic every week. He was the first guy to break. He did the, you know, that little trick when you pour the juice and you put the mic near it. You hear like the sound of, you're like, ooh, aesthetics, you know, that was him. And then the second week he was like, you help with everything, and I was helping with it. And the third week he's like, you do it alone. And some of you have heard that story. I actually broke the communion bread under my armpit, and we won't go any further down that story road. And then the fourth week he said, I'm leaving. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, I've decided I don't want to be a pastor anymore. And so the fifth week I was alone with the now associate pastor who had stepped into the role, and I thought, oh man, I wanted to learn from this person who was doing it on the edge, doing it on the margins, embracing the mess. And then he left, and he actually left the whole region for a while, and then almost a decade later came back, and when we met up to talk, said, yeah, I don't even know if I believe in any of this Christian stuff anymore. I don't know if I believe in God. I don't know if I believe in church. And I remember just feeling so rocked by that, because I had been so thrilled that this was a person who seemed to be able to sit at the edge of that, and then to see them kind of just walk away from that edge of faith and totally out, it just really messed with me. And what's worse is a lot of the people that I really was inspired by over the years, especially those formative years I had in seminary, like the musicians and the artists and the pastors, a lot of them ended up walking away from faith. Anybody else in this room have like that Christian musician? You're like, I just love how honest he is. And he's like, I'm honestly not a Christian anymore. And you're like, oh, further than I wish you went. A little uncomfortable there. Like, that what you loved, you know, I'm not judging people who walk away from faith. There's a lot of good reasons to not do this on a Sunday. I understand. But it really left me feeling a little hesitant, because it's also what I've invested so much into. Like, I have so wanted churches where people are honest and people talk about what's actually happening and they are comfortable with their doubts and they're okay with the mess and it's bring in everybody. And then you see over a decade a bunch of people that do that, that just kind of keep on slippery sloping until they're all the way to the faith, and suddenly it's like, oh my goodness, what if we're wrong? What if we should have like super strict dogma and lists and rules? Because it seems like if you don't, you might just lose the whole thing. Has anyone else ever felt this? That maybe actually the fundamentalism is the right way to go with this. Really strict rules. And so I've been wrestling with that and trying to really ask the question, what does it look like to follow Jesus when you find yourself honest, prophetic, critiquing, on the edge? And what does it look like to do that well? So, okay, I'm going to take us to a biblical text. It's in the Gospel of Luke. We can throw it up here. It's also in your Bibles, Luke 15, if you have a pew Bible. Very well-known story. I'm going to try to just bring the text out in a couple different ways. Many of you will be very familiar with this text. For some of you, this might be a new text, but this is Jesus teaching. And he's teaching to a crowd of people, but especially present in the crowd are some of the religious leaders. And so he tells this story about what God's kingdom is like. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.'" Most of you would understand, of course, that if you're asking for your share of the estate, you're asking for your inheritance. And so here you've got a son, a young son, saying to his father, it's not quite like I wish you were dead, but it's you would be more good to me if you gave me your stuff and we ended this relationship. I want out of this family. I want out. I want to cash out my resources. When the father died, he would have split the land up between all of the sons. Oldest son would get a bit more. Sorry, daughters. Not cool, but it's a long time ago. And he wants his inheritance now. So the father actually honors his request, which is wild, and divides his property between his two sons. Not long after that, the younger son got together all that he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth with wild living. And so Jesus is telling this to a Jewish audience, probably a Jewish character. This far-off country is some other land, the Gentile lands, the lands of people that don't look like them or talk like them or eat like them or worship the God that they worship. And so the younger son takes his money that his father's given him, he runs off to another land, and he squanders it, he spends it poorly, he parties, he celebrates fast and loose. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country. And he began to be in need. And the friends that he gathered when he had resources and had money and the good times were going, his friends leave him and abandon him. His resources and social networks fall apart. He's got no family. He's got no heritage there. He's alone in a foreign land that's now experiencing a famine. And so he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. Most of us would be aware that a good Jewish boy, Jesus is telling this story, but a good Jewish boy who's gone off to a far land, you're not supposed to eat pig, right? The Jews didn't particularly fond of pigs. Pigs would be raised by non-Jewish families. And so he's now working with pigs, and it gets even worse. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And so Jesus is setting up this character that he's hit bottom. He's so low, not only is he among the foreign people and their dirty, disgusting pigs, not only is he working with and cleaning and feeding the pigs, he actually longs to eat what the pigs eat. He longs to become a pig, to become an unclean animal. And so Jesus is setting this up as this guy has gone as low as you can go. He has ruined his family name. He has ruined his family's money. He has dishonored everyone. And now he is functionally longing to become a pig, but they won't even let him do that. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death." His family's quite well off. His dad's got whole servants, just people that come in and work in the homes, and they've got all this food, and he is here starving to death, looking at the pig food. He says, "I will set out and go to my father and say to him," I like this, the son's got a plan, I like this a lot. He says, "Okay, I'm going to say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven, I've sinned against God, and I've sinned against you. And I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" He doesn't even say, "Make me like one of your slaves." Many of the households at this time would have had slaves. And a slave, while a slave was owned by the ruler of a home, a slave was also considered part of the wider family. So a slave would live in the home, be taken care of in the home, be provided for in the home. And so there was a certain amount of family structure to that. He's saying, "I wouldn't even want to be in the home. I just want my dad to hire me. Like, just to be a servant. Just hire me to work for you so that I can eat. So he's got this whole plan, this whole speech planned out. And he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. I don't know about you, this is one of those stories that, like, I've heard this one. This is one of Jesus's, like, all-time greatest hits. Right? You've heard this one. And yet, it just doesn't get old. Like, can you imagine, put yourself in the father's shoes. Your kid has squandered everything. Blew probably about a third of the money that you have, your home. You had to sell property and livestock just to cash him out. You gave him what he wanted. He goes off. He abuses it. You hear rumors that not only is he living a horrible lifestyle, now you hear rumors that he's working with pigs. Now you hear rumors that he's becoming an unclean animal. And yet when he's far off, it's like the father's been standing there just waiting, looking in the horizon, just waiting. And when he sees him, he does stuff that men would never do in this culture, head of the household. You don't pull up your dress and run down to your son. He would have been wearing a dress. You don't run down to your son. You don't embrace him. You don't kiss his face. You've just got a picture, like, you know when you're hugging someone and they're really sobbing and you pull off and you're just soaked on your shoulder? It's the soaked on the shoulder. It's grabbing his face, his dirty, stinky, pig-covered face, and it's kissing his face and washing it with his tears and just mwah, 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 in his beard, on his face, tears, cleaning his boy up. And then the boy, I love this, the son launches into his speech. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son." And then boom, right away, the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe." Like, you just got to get that. He's crying. He's just being kissed. He's like, "Father, I've sinned again." No, stop it. Bring the best robe. Put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf. Like, this is the big one, the fattened calf. You might have one as a family. Bring it. We may be saving this for a wedding someday. Bring it over. Let's have a feast and celebrate. The fattened calf, you're inviting the whole village. Invite everyone in. Let's celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. And that right there is a good story. And most of us have heard at least that much of this story. But Jesus kind of carries it on with this next scene that is familiar to many of us, but not quite as often told. When you're a kid, like the Jesus Storybook Bible that I read to Clem this morning, I read this story to her, totally cut out the next part. They just stick to the basics. But the story keeps going, and it's really good as well. Meanwhile, all this is happening. It's a party. Fire's getting stoked. Servants are coming out. People from around town are coming in. And the older son is way out in the field. He can see the house. Maybe the house is being lit up. He sees some traffic. And he hears the music. And he hears the dancing. He's way out there working, but he hears it all. And he calls out to one of the servants. He says, "Hey, what's going on?" And the servant yells back, "Your brother has come," he replied. "And your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. There's a party. Come on, your brother's back." Next slide. But the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So, and I love this detail. Much like the one son, he runs to meet him on the road. In this case, the father again goes out. So the father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years, I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." And I don't necessarily disagree with the brother on this one. Anybody else feel like, yeah, you got a little bit of righteous indignation going on here, right? You've been here. Some of you know this, got family dynamics like this. Someone's off running around, ruining their lives, ruining your name, ruining it all. And you're here, and you're working. You're in the field. And he shows up, and there's a party? Like, I'm sorry? I get it. But that frustration, that kind of, you know, righteous frustration, quickly starts turning into something else. And you can see it in his words, right? It says, this son of yours, not my brother, this son of yours. Or this other line, which is just so core. All these years, I've been slaving away for you. Not all these years I've been your son. All these years we've been in the family business together. All these years we've been side by side. All these years I've been here doing this stuff for you. I've been a slave for you. And you can just feel the father's heart breaking as he realizes that his son doesn't consider himself part of this family. The son considers himself somebody who has to prove something, work out something, earn something from his father. And the father says, my son, you are always with me. And everything I have is yours. Which is true. He's actually given all the other inheritance to the son. Literally, the father's not overstating this. Everything I possess is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So we have a story of two sons. The one son runs away and leaves. The other son stays put and works. And both of the sons are lost. This is something that, there's a book by Tim Keller called The Prodigal God that gets at this in far more detail. This is the observation that he and many others have pointed out, that you've got two sons, and even though one is gone and one is present, they're actually both lost. One's left and one's made himself a slave. One's lost to vices and one's lost to self-righteousness. But both of them are missing the father's love. Does that make sense? So in the church, we are much better at seeing when younger sons get lost. Because they were sitting in church, and then they started hockey practice, and then you never see them again. You're like, oh, that family and their hockey son. And now they're backsliding, you know, like, it's really easy. You just notice. You notice the absence. So the church has been really good at noticing when people leave. But we have not done a very good job at noticing that there are people who stay in church communities, who check the Christian box, and yet over years become hardened in our hearts and become a little more judgmental. Everybody else out having a good time on Sunday. And here I am, stuck in a church. At least it's not cold today, but I talked to a pastor once who said that as he drove in from Burlington to the church he pastored, he wanted to yell at all the people he saw sitting on the front porch drinking their morning coffee, go to church! I was like, oh yeah, that'll get them. Yeah, they'll just be like, wait, what? It's clearly working so well for you. But over time, you feel like, well, here I am, slaving away for you. That you can have people sitting in churches that over the years, arms are crossed, heart is cold, spirit is more and more judgmental and bitter, and the life is sucked up, but because they're in church and they're tithing, churches are more than happy to just let it go. So, I have always been drawn to people who set up shop on the edge of faith. People who like to be adventurers. People who maybe are a little more prone biologically to be leavers. And when I've watched these people lose their faith, it breaks my heart. And it's hurt and sometimes disappointed me. But at the same time, there are lots of us in this room. And I hate to say it, if you're in this room, no matter how cool you are, you're at least a little bit of an older brother. Because you're here. And I've seen many people, just like me, who are sitting and doing the right thing all the time, but losing faith in a different kind of way. And so I was reflecting on these things. Younger brothers walk away physically, older brothers walk away spiritually. There's two ways to lose your faith. And then I was like, I got it. This is going to be great. Because then at the end, I'll say, the question is, like, which are you? And then you guys will be like, wow, great question, Kevin. And it's like, yeah, are you like, this is what I do when I write sermons. I put all of you in it. And it's like, wow, I'm like an older brother, and I feel like I'm in church, I'm doing the right thing, and I'm doing it the right way, but I have grown judgmental of those who walk away, and yes, I must change. And some of you would be like, no, bro, I'm a younger brother, and like, I have wandered away, and I've squandered my inheritance, and I've rebelled against God, and I need to be aware of that and then come back. And I was like, truly, self-awareness will save us all. And then Jill was like, oh yeah, have you read Henry Nouwen on this? I was like, yeah, like a long time ago. He's Nouwen, like, he floats around. He does. Henry Nouwen's one of those, he's a Christian writer, he's a Catholic, and, you know, it's like, yeah, Nouwen, I'm sure he's got great stuff to say. You know, beloved, Jesus loves me and I'm beloved. Got it. She was like, you should, I know, it's a good thing he's not going to hear this podcast. Henry Nouwen's brilliant, which you'll be convinced of in 1 second. Because then she was like, oh yeah, well, he wrote this book called The Life of the Beloved, and I should just read you a section from it. I was like, I mean, sure, but like, this sermon's perfect, Jill. Like, we've already nailed it. Like, sure, read your little Nouwen section. And then she did. And I realized that there was this whole other part of this text that I was missing. That the question isn't just, are you a younger or an older brother? The question is, what do you do with that information? And where do you go from here? So Jill's going to come up and read this excerpt from Henry Nouwen's book, The Prodigal Son.
From the beginning, I was prepared to accept that not only the younger son, but also the elder son would reveal to me an important aspect of my spiritual journey. For a long time, the father remained the other, the one who would receive me, forgive me, offer me a home, and give me peace and joy. The Father was the place to return to, the goal of my journey, the final resting place. It was only gradually, and often quite painfully, that I came to realize that my spiritual journey would never be complete as long as the Father remained an outsider. Though I am both the younger son and the elder son, I am not to remain them, but to become the father. No father or mother ever became father or mother without having been son or daughter. But every son and daughter has to consciously choose to step beyond their childhood and become father and mother for others. It is a hard and lonely step to take, especially in a period of history in which parenthood is so hard to live well. But it is a step that is essential for the fulfillment of the spiritual journey. It feels somehow good to be able to say, these sons are like me. It gives a sense of being understood. But how does it feel to say, the Father is like me? Do I want to be like the Father? Do I want to be not just the one who is being forgiven, but also the one who forgives? Not just the one who is being welcomed home, but also the one who welcomes home. Not just the one who receives compassion, but the one who offers it as well.
So all of these sermons on spiritual maturity and spiritual growth as kind of a general theme started when a few of us were doing some reflections on Eucharist as a church and what we communally needed to hear in this season. And Dave Witt said, you know, I think, yeah, maybe you should preach on spiritual growth. And I said this the first week, my immediate reaction was, ugh. Like, I was just like, yuck, no, I don't want to talk about spirit. Ignore the pigeon, it's God's blessing. And I had this guttural reaction of like, no. And Dave was like, that's a weird reaction. I was like, yeah, that was kind of a weird reaction. And I dug in, like, why? a lot of these sermons, I've just been trying to understand why. What is it about this idea of spiritual maturity and spiritual growth that hits me as just frightening and weird? And part of it, I articulated back in the first week that we did on this, part of it is that spiritual maturity has often been seen as a way to spiritually self-improve, that you've got to keep getting better and better, you've got to keep growing and growing, and you've got to work harder and harder. And that is truly, I think, something that we should, as Christians, critique, that if our faith is being saved by God's grace, it can't also be, so try really hard. So there was that. But I also realized that part of why I pushed back against the idea of spiritual maturity is because I don't know if I want to grow up. I don't know. I don't know if I want to be healthy. Do I? Do I want to become the father? I've been the young Christian my whole life. I've been a young pastor for a decade. And everywhere you go, people just think it's adorable. And then you get to do silly things and you make a mistake. It's like, oh, just a kid. But maybe I shouldn't be anymore. Maybe you shouldn't be anymore. Maybe it's not even an age thing. Maybe that's just a part of it. I think all of us struggle, whatever age we're in, to put on that mantle of being the father, being the mother, of saying, I'm going to let somebody rely on me. And that's scary. Do I want to forgive? Do I want to be the one that sits and waits for someone else? To become the father, to become the mother, is to allow other people to leave and hurt you. It's to be the first one to run out there and grab them by the face and kiss someone and let your tears wash their face. It's to lose your inheritance and your estate, to sacrifice all that you have and get nothing in return from any earthly standards. It's to welcome somebody back with a celebration and a party. It's to be wounded. And I know that's what Jesus lived like, and I know that's the path of Christ. But I think a lot of us struggle to ask, do I really want to become the anchor for someone else? I'm scared to grow up because people have disappointed me. And I'm scared that I'll disappoint someone else. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but who in this room has been hurt or disappointed by somebody? And then there's that feeling that the best way to avoid hurting anyone is then just to remove yourself from any responsibility. That if I don't try to help anyone else, then I can't disappoint anyone else and I can't hurt anyone else. But I don't think we're called to be perfect fathers and mothers. I think we're just called to show up. We're called to say yes to the question of, do I want to grow up? Jill pointed out when we were talking about this, she's like, the good news is, as you know, to go biological parenthood for a second, she's like, they start as babies. I was like, that is a really good point. Like, I don't know what to do with a 14-year-old. The good news is, I got about 12 years. It starts with one or two. It starts with one or two or three and a baby. And it starts with waking up during the night. And it starts with changing a diaper. And then it gets to potty training and helping them eat. And then it gets to sending them off. And then it gets to my daughter saying that some kid in the class pulls her hair. And I'm like, who? I'm going to punt him. And then I'm like, that's illegal. And so I've got to talk to my daughter about how to say, no, this is my body. You don't do that. And I have to learn that. And then I have to learn how to help her forgive people. And then I've got to learn how to help her navigate relationships. And the infinite complexity as you go up. But it starts with a yes. That's physical children. What I love about Henry Nouwen is he was never a biological parent. Henry Nouwen was a priest, but he was a father. In God's kingdom, this isn't about biology. This is about spiritual parenting and spiritual family. And the challenge with spiritual family is you have to choose it every day. Biologically, you can choose it once and you're stuck with it. But when it comes to spiritual parenting, you have to take on the voluntary risk of loving someone else and investing in someone else and trying to be some sort of spiritual father or mother for someone else. And that's a frightening thing. But I think that's the question to ask. And so I've decided I do want to grow up. I don't want to get boring. It's not boring. It's not about taking on a bunch of burdens, but it is about saying yes. It's about becoming the you that God made you to become and going to the places where he's called you to be. And so I guess I just leave that as an open question, a sermon without clear resolution. Do you want to become the father? Do you want to become the mother? Do you want to say yes?